It's time to turn things around. Trickle up, not trickle down. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. See it? It's time. It's time to turn things around. Trickle up, not trickle down. God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Now, is that chorus again? Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Me and you. And when drill, baby drill, turns to spill, baby spill, God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Try it. Yes, when bill, baby drill, turns to spill, baby spill, God's counting on me. God's counting on you. Sing it with harmony. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Hope and we'll all pull through. Me and you.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with the wonderful Pete Seeger, live at a Gulf Coast oil spill fundraiser at the City Winery in New York City on July 23rd. This is Pete Seeger unveiling his new protest song about the BP oil spill, and as you hear, it's called God's Counting on Me, God's Counting on You. Backing up Pete Seeger is James Maddock on acoustic guitar. And, of course, you can hear the audience participation, too. So all of the proceeds from this concert went to the Gulf Restoration Project. On today's show, after a brief update with Dodger Mail on the Gulf of Mexico catastrophe, we turn to the upcoming 65th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 9th, respectively. We talk with Dr. Joseph Gerson, Director of Programs of the American Friends Services Committee in New England and AFSC's National Disarmament Coordinator. Dr. Gerson is also co-convener of the May 2010 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review. We also talk with Mary Leah Kelly, Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares, that is, Tri-Valley's Community Against a Radioactive Environment.
And when drill, baby drill, turns to spill, baby spill, God's counting on me, God's counting on you. Try it. Yes, when...
It's my great pleasure to welcome Dar Jamail back to Raising Sand Radio. Good to have you with us again, Dar.
Thanks, Susan. Good to be with you.
Well, you have been with us now doing an update for, I think this is the third update you've done after your visit to the Gulf of Mexico. You're back home now, so let's talk about how you're taking in all of the information that you've gathered in the last 3 or 4 weeks before you go back.
Well, we just got home, and we spent a month there and have so much information to continue publishing, which we'll continue to do over these next few weeks. It's kind of a relief to get home, though, because it's really such an intense situation down on the coast. It's such a big thing, this oil spill, on so many levels, and so it's really hard to try to kind of take it in and have perspective on it. This thing's so big and so long-lasting, and we're still just very much at the very beginning of it.
The last time we talked, we were expecting the hurricane. Bonnie was out there somewhere. You were there during that, weren't you?
Correct. It was never a hurricane. It made it as strong as a tropical storm, which is one notch below a Category 1 hurricane. And then it kind of fizzled out once it passed over Florida, and then basically came ashore late Saturday evening in New Orleans with just heavy rain and some winds and lightning and such. But what it essentially did is every time big weather hits a lot of oil that's on the surface, is it does disperse it a bit, throw it around, break it up, and a lot of it sinks. In the aftermath now, we're seeing just different patches and tarball patches and smaller slicks now washing up still out on the outskirts of Chandelier Islands. I was just checking just right before our call. So there's still a lot of oil coming up in different places, and you know, at first glance, one thinks, oh, great, the hurricane or the big weather broke up some of the oil, but ultimately, this is causing a situation that is not dissimilar to that of the heavy use of dispersants, where it's breaking up all of this oil. That doesn't mean it's making it go away. That just means it's breaking it up into smaller bits that even most scientists now are reporting they don't even expect all of it's going down to the bottom, that it is still staying in the water column, and we're going to have to just wait and keep doing loads of scientific studies and see how this stuff's infiltrating the food chain. We already have a lot of proof that it's in blue crab larvae. We already know that it's wiping out a lot of the shrimp population, a lot of the oyster populations along the coast, particularly in Louisiana. And so it's a very dangerous thing now to consider that the vast majority of this oil that has been gushed into the Gulf is underwater, and it's not on the surface, but it's not on the ocean floor or the Gulf floor either. And it is floating around in the water column. It's still wiping out wildlife, marine life, and that stuff that it doesn't kill is eating it and then being eaten by other things, and then eventually we eat those things. So that's what we all need to keep thinking about.
And with the demise of Hayward now, how is BP managing the public relations side of this?
Well, BP is in the midst of a huge PR effort as we speak, and it's continuing, and a major component of that is getting rid of Tony Hayward. I mean, this was a guy who basically was just making one gaffe after another of saying these absurdly offensive things, and he is in the process now. He's officially going to be stepping down October 1 to be replaced by an American who's basically kind of took over for Hayward in running the response effort, and he doesn't make as many gaffes. He's a lot better spoken. But the reality is that this is just part of a big PR thing, because when we look at what's going on the ground, supposedly there was this $20 billion slush fund set up to compensate people. It's being run by Feinberg. Not one dime of it has been paid out yet. Feinberg himself is being paid by BP to do this, won't disclose the amount of money he's being paid to distribute these monies. So a lot of people are very up in arms about this and very suspicious, and I think rightly so. At the same time, we still have oil washing ashore. We still have the brunt of fishing closed. People's lives are wiped out along the coast, particularly in Louisiana and much of Mississippi and parts of Alabama. And then another thing that I want to point out is that there's been so much propaganda around that the well is capped, and that now they're getting ready to drill down in and put the relief wells in. And the reality is it's capped, but we have independent scientists confirming that there's at least five places where gases are seeping up around the wellhead down there. And, of course, the BP and the compliant U.S. Coast Guard keep saying, well, this is no big deal. This is not a problem. And the independent scientists are begging to differ, because this is showing that there's real possibility for a bigger rupture if they leave this cap on and don't get this relief well done, of which there's a distinct possibility they may not succeed. Many people deep inside the oil industry actually believe that they won't succeed at all. And so that would force them to either take the cap back off to relieve this pressure or leave it on and continue to risk a major rupture. And if that happened, they literally would be unable to stop it. So this is a very, very tenuous situation. We're still at the very beginning of this thing. There's lives at stake. There's livelihoods at stake. The health of the Gulf is at stake. And I just want to urge people to remember that, you know, this is anything but over. We're still at the very beginning of this.
That was Dar Jamail, our special correspondent, doing weekly updates from the Gulf catastrophe. Visit his blog, dar.org, for more and to see Erica Blumenfeld's spectacular photographs. Dar Jamail will be with us again next week for another update. And also, if you want an excellent view with humor and irony into what is going on with BP, British Petroleum, in the Gulf, Gary Trudeau's cartoon Doonesbury has it. Check it out by doing a search online for under the keyword Doonesbury, and you'll find it. And he's been following it, and he has a very interesting and right-on perspective, and I highly recommend that you follow this cartoon as it unfolds.
Baby, spill, God's counting on me. God's counting on you. sing it with harmony. Hope and Bill are all through. Hope and Bill are all through. Hope and Bill are all through. Me and you.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Joseph Gerson to Raising Sand Radio. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. You are the Director of Programs of the American Friends Service Committee in New England and AFSC's National Disarmament Coordinator. Your current work is focusing on advancing the United States and international movements for the abolition of nuclear weapons and the ratification of the Limited New START Treaty. What's interesting, Dr. Gerson, especially, is that you served as the co-convener of the 2010 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review International Planning Committee, which is a network of 25 leading disarmament organizations from Japan, the United States, Europe, and Israel, created to help ensure a successful NPT review conference. So it's great to have you with us. We're going to talk about all of that. But let's begin, Dr. Gerson, with your upcoming trip to Hiroshima at the end of the month. Will you be there for the anniversary of the bombings on August 6th and 9th?
Yes. For the last, 55 years, there's been an annual international conference held in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, both to commemorate the what are really war crimes and the victims of those war crimes, and to do planning in terms of how to press for the abolition of nuclear weapons, whose destructive capacity is really beyond our ability to comprehend what it is.
I wonder what it's like to be there as a member of the society that actually bombed these people. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I've been there actually many times. I've been working closely with the Japanese peace movement now for about 25 years. The first time that most people go there who have, you know, kind of a sense of historical consciousness and who have the opportunity to meet with A-bomb survivors is to go as deeply as you can into understanding the pain and the suffering of the people there, to imagine a city that was destroyed in 9 seconds, everything within essentially a 2-mile radius, and to engage with the pain of the effects, the genetic damage and other of the radiation. So it's a pretty deep and hard experience. At the same time, what I found is that I remember after returning the first time, I hadn't dreamt while I was in Japan, but when I came back, I finally was dreaming. And was dreaming through the cinders and the paint of it all. But the waking image I had was of the colors and the angles of the peace grains, which are a symbol of peace and affirmation of life. And you also, within the Japanese peace movement, certainly experience a deep commitment to life and to creating a peaceful world. And that sort of really kind of brings you further along. Another thing that happens, I think, for many people who go to Hiroshima is a sense of shock in that today it's really a beautiful modern city. I mean, the city was destroyed, and the people in the community set about rebuilding it. So it's quite modern, more Western-looking than most people would anticipate. Even has a baseball stadium. Their team is the Hiroshima Corp. So there's this kind of disjunction between the Hiroshima of our imaginations and the Hiroshima of today.
Mm. Thank you for sharing those dream images. That was really lovely. You began in your intro using the term war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fly in the United States these days?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. But it's interesting. I had a recent meeting with a senior staff member of a senator. We're trying to get to vote correctly on the START ratification, the new START treaty ratification. And his I think what I would describe as ignorant response was that the bombing of Hiroshima was right. It just reflects just such enormous ignorance. And we had an opportunity 10 years ago on the 50th anniversary of the A-bombing. The Smithsonian Institute in Washington was getting ready to mount a major exhibit, which would have described both some of the unknown history behind the decision to drop the bomb, and would have had images of the suffering it caused. But right-wing forces, particularly led by the Air Force Association, blocked it, and the display was canceled. And I think that was really a setback, really for the U.S. people.
Mm-hmm.
I think very few people understand that in late 44, the Emperor of Hiroshima, who was certainly a war criminal himself, changed governments because he understood that the war was lost, and the mandate of the new government was to negotiate a peace treaty with the United States, the fundamental condition from their end being that the emperor not be put off the throne or tried as a war criminal. There were efforts made, contacts with our diplomats and OSS in Portugal, in Sweden, in Basel, through the Vatican, to negotiate such a settlement. Truman was well aware on his way to Potsdam, for example. He learned that the Japanese were attempting to send a diplomat to Moscow to help negotiate into the war. You had later to be President Eisenhower when he's a general opposing the A-bombing. Secretary of War Stimson had even talked about it in terms of an atrocity which would lead us to have a reputation of competing with Hitler. You had Admiral Leahy, who was opposed to it. The understanding was Japan was already defeated. But Truman went ahead with it principally as a means to bring the war to an immediate end so we wouldn't have to share influence with the Soviet Union in Asia, and as a way to essentially attempt to intimidate the Soviets for the post-war period.
Do you think that this history, it's kind of a secret history of the United States, isn't it? Do you think?
Well, it's been written, but, you know, it's the only people who really know it are students who study history and
exactly.
Study that particular time in history.
Is there a tendency now in the climate that we live in the United States to paint that over in a different way, present a different picture to what actually happened?
Well, I think there's a classical example of this. There's a new film coming out called Countdown to Zero, which comes from really from sectors of the national security elite about the dangers of nuclear weapons. There's a very passing reference to the A bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Very little focus on what the weapons really did. Nothing really about why the A-bombs were dropped, and then just moving on to focus about the threat and dangers of terrorists. So the United States tends to be an ahistoric or anti-historical society. This is now 65 years ago, and it's unhappy and unpleasant history, so we tend not to look at it.
And I wonder if that also influences how we look at war in this country today.
Well, absolutely. And what I argue is that were the U.S. people to really face what we did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were we to face the fact that the A-bombings had almost nothing to do with the end of the war, it would remove the sense of legitimacy for our preparations for nuclear war. And that's sort of the key string to pull in terms of moving for nuclear abolition worldwide.
When you worked on the 2010 NPT Treaty Review, does that history, our way of looking at things in this country, influence how comprehensive that treaty can become?
Well, you know, I can't say precisely what it is in their heart of hearts that Barack Obama, Susan Rice, and others really think and believe. But what we do know is that the United States signed the NPT Treaty, which is really one of the seminal treaties of the 20th century. It has essentially three elements. One, the non-nuclear nations commit not to obtain nuclear weapons, with the exceptions of India, Pakistan, and Israel, who didn't sign. And the nuclear nations made two promises. One, that they would provide technology and recognize the inalienable right of all nations to produce nuclear power for peaceful purposes, which was a mistake, but it's international law. And most importantly, in Article 6, they committed to engage in good faith negotiations to completely eliminate their nuclear arsenals. Well, guess what? They haven't done that. And when the non-nuclear nations say, what about your commitment here? It's undermining our ability to remain non-nuclear because you keep threatening us with these weapons and we want more of an equal playing field. What you have is, led by the United States, the nuclear powers, saying no. So despite President Obama's rhetoric, what we had at the NPT review conference last May was the United States beating back proposals by the non-aligned movement nations and others, pressing for a mandate, a requirement, that the nuclear powers begin the negotiations that would completely eliminate their arsenals. This is, as President Bill Clinton said years ago, nuclear weapons are the cornerstone of our policies. Mm-hmm. And one of the difficult things to know and to have to say to people is that, you know, each thermonuclear weapon has the capability of killing far more people than were killed in Auschwitz. These are ultimately genocidal, if not homicidal, weapons. And what that means is that the cornerstone of our policies is preparation and threats to initiate genocide and homicide. And that's an element of our society, of our nation, that it's in everybody's interest to address and transform.
Mm. As I understand it, many Arab countries were balking at signing the treaty unless Israel signed. And as what you're saying now is that Israel, in fact, didn't sign.
Well, the Arab nations signed. Really, the only three nations that haven't signed are India, Pakistan, and Israel. What we had during the NPT review conference was a demand by the initiated from the Arab League, but then also pressed very hard by the non-aligned movement of nations, that a conference be held, that progress be made toward the negotiation of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. And this is, among other things, the best way to stanch an Iranian nuclear program. But Israel certainly didn't want it. The Obama administration was not thrilled with it. But in the end, both because it was needed to advance President Obama's larger strategies and to avoid the collapse of the conference, the U.S. agreed to it and agreed to have Israel named within the document, which caused considerable consternation within Israel.
So the consternation being that so far Israel has maintained that they do not have any nuclear weapons, and here the cover is a little lifted.
Well,
a little.
It's not only that the cover is blown; it's really been blown for quite a while. I mean, it's as they say, the worst kept secret. But I was on a panel with an Egyptian ambassador during the review conference, and as he said, you know, with the Middle East nuclear weapons free zone conference in 2012. They're not expecting, you know, immediate elimination of the Israeli nuclear arsenal. But from their perception, by having it in the document, by naming Israel, it puts pressure on Israel around which other nations can build, with the goal of trying to remove that threat of nuclear war. And I should add that it really is in everybody's interest to move in this direction. You know, the Israelis say they live in a dangerous neighborhood. Hillary Clinton said that recently, President Obama. But to understand that just down the, you know, Iran lives in the same neighborhood, but just up the road from them are Israel and its roughly 400 nuclear weapons. So that's a strong incentive for Iran to move toward becoming a nuclear power. The reality is, as Iran moves closer to actually becoming a nuclear power, it may not actually build a bomb, but may move to a point where it could build one within a week or two, as they say, a screwdriver away. Mm-hmm. If that happens, you're going to see a proliferation of nuclear weapons throughout the Middle East, Egypt, Kuwait, other countries, and that makes for a very dangerous situation.
It does, yeah. How does the building of nuclear weapons affect the United States, the land, and the people here, because this is not a clean technology?
No. People should remember when the Soviet Union collapsed that we found that it was an absolutely environmental disaster. And we have much the same here, with poisons even from the first atomic bombs in places like St. Louis. And these are radiation, you know, has a half-life of what, 28,000 years.
Yeah.
So these poisons are there for a very long time. You know, people who've been particularly devastated have been the Native Americans, on whose land the uranium is often found, and often without education have been brought into hauling the ore. And cancer is widespread, even among the miners. Then you've got the from the production of the weapons. You've got fallout, more poisoning of workers. From the testing, even the underground testing, you had venting. An estimate of as much as a million U.S. people who've been pretty severely devastated by the radiation.
Mm.
I have more friends than I want to remember who, here in the United States, who've died as a result of you know, the radiation from the production cycle and the testing, and people who are now struggling for their lives.
Mm. I actually live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we're involved right now in the cleanup of Hunter's Point.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of contamination there, and the communities around there are suffering a lot.
Right, right.
And there's a tendency to just want to, you know, put a cap on this contaminated land and put people on top to live.
No, I mean, one of the real disasters here is that not only with nuclear weapons, but with nuclear power, we've engaged, we've built a dependency on producing these poisons that will poison the land, you know, for seemingly ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best we can do is to at this stage, you know, halt the production of the weapons, halt the production of nuclear power, move to consolidate the fissile materials. And move some of the money we spend from the military into really intensive scientific work in terms of how we can best contain these dangers.
And Dr. Gerson, that's not going to happen unless people here in the United States mobilize and get to understand exactly what we're dealing with. How would you suggest we do that?
Well, I think there's a whole range of ways to do it. You know, this film ostensibly is designed to Countdown to Zero is ostensibly designed to kind of increase nuclear consciousness, but unfortunately, I think it focuses more on the context of the war on terror. But I think teachers need to be real teachers. Our religious institutions, I mean, we need to exercise what we have out there in a civil and civic society. You know, certainly demonstrations, vigils, leafleting, all of these things help. You know, we're trying to do our best through the Internet right now to encourage, try to win the votes of seven Republicans for the ratification of the New START Treaty. We're working to try to help people understand how much money is being spent for nuclear weapons and how this money might otherwise be used, especially in the time of great recession. For job creation and the investment we need for a 21st century economy, because our children and grandchildren are not going to have the economic opportunities that my generation has had unless we really make those investments.
Mm. How can listeners go and learn more? Is there a website or a way to
contact? Well, there's a number of websites. They can go to www.afsc.org. They can Google Peace Action has some good information. Western States Legal Foundation. There's really a host of organizations that can be found.
Thank you so much for being with us. Would you like to add anything that we haven't covered that you think listeners should know about?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people need to understand the urgency of getting rid of nuclear weapons, and to understand that you know, in theory, we're a democratic society. Democracy isn't handed down. You have to struggle for it, and you have to make the change. We can't, you know, just to go back to the word change, we shouldn't expect Barack Obama to give it to us. We've got to take it.
Dr. Joseph Gerson, again, American Friends Service Committee in New England, where he is National Disarmament Coordinator, among other things. Before we turn to Mary Leah Kelly, Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares, or Communities Against a Radioactive Environment, let me remind you that you are listening to Raising Sand Radio, and I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. We air original shows like this one each week, as well as archive all of our shows for anyone to download for free. We're pleased to have listeners all over the world, so a shout-out to listeners in far-flung places, Australia, South Africa, Egypt, Jordan, Canada, Norway sometimes, around the United States. Thank you for listening and tuning in. And our website is raisingsandradio.org. We are a project of Motherspeak, and we're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. Go to the website, raisingsandradio.org, to find our range of progressive topics and download, as I say, any of those for free. And please think about assisting our work in getting these important words out and about in the world by making a tax-deductible donation to Raising Sand Radio via motherspeak.org. We're also looking for sponsors and underwriters. Underwriting is on-air credit that organizations receive for providing funds to defray the cost of news, public affairs, and other programs that we feature here on Raising Sand Radio. Underwriting combines the benefits of advertising with sound public relations. Public radio sponsorship announcements build awareness and credibility for your organization and your work. Underwriters are also acknowledged in Raising Sand's radio monthly program update and on our website. So if you want to know more about that, or if you just want to get in touch with me, it's susan@raisingsandradio.org. Tri-Valley Cares, that is, Communities Against a Radioactive Environment, was founded in 1983 in Livermore, California, by concerned neighbors living around the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of two locations where all U.S. nuclear weapons are designed. Tri-Valley Cares monitors nuclear weapons and environmental cleanup activities throughout the U.S. nuclear weapons complex, with a special focus on Livermore Lab and the surrounding communities. With me today is Mary Leah Kelly, Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares. Mary Leah Kelly brings 27 years of in-depth research, writing, and facilitating public participation in decisions regarding the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, as well as the U.S. nuclear weapons complex, nuclear weapons, waste, and cleanup. Since 1989, Mary Leah Kelly has served on the Community Work Group to advise the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, state agencies, and the community on the Superfund cleanup of toxic and radioactive pollution at Livermore Lab. Welcome, Mary Leah Kelly.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's really great to have you. As we gear up to recognize the 65th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Tri-Valley Cares is presenting events such as Resistance for a Nuclear-Free Future and Think Outside the Bomb. We want to hear more about that. But let's begin with your work at Tri-Valley Cares.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, I believe we were founded in 1983. And back then, everybody who lived here sort of only knew that there was a super secret nuclear weapons laboratory, but not a lot about what went on inside the laboratory, and certainly nothing about the environmental and health impacts. So both on a nuclear weapons policy level and on an environmental level, we decided to conduct intense research using the California Public Records Act, the Federal Freedom of Information Act, and all of the things that, for example, I had learned with a background in journalism, to really look at what was going on. And what we found out was, frankly, even more shocking than what we had imagined. With respect to nuclear weapons policy, you know, we had understood that it was a busy two-way street between Livermore Laboratory and the weapons designers and the management there, and, you know, Washington, D.C., and the Department of Energy and the Pentagon and the Congress. But the lab had always said that they only respond to Congress and to the President and to the Pentagon in terms of what kinds of weapons designs they wanted. Well, we found out that the lab, in fact, sells its ideas rather forcefully. Mm. And so the labs, the weapons labs up here at Livermore and at Los Alamos in New Mexico, really are the taproot of the nuclear arms race, during the Cold War, and now the sort of one-nation nuclear arms race that we've been continuing ever since the Cold War. And so when you weed whack, you know, the tops of these programs, one program at a time, these are terrific victories. But as long as the weapons labs are unimpeded, that taproot of continued weapons design, continued weapons development will go on and even flourish. So that's one of the lessons from our research. Another is that here in Livermore, and in fact everywhere in the country and in the world where the nuclear weapons cycle is occurring, there is environmental devastation and there are health impacts. Here in Livermore, we've been able to document that more than 1 million curies of radiation have escaped from the laboratory. And some of your listeners may say, so what's 1 million curies? One way to look at it is one curie of radiation is a large amount. That's 37 billion radioactive disintegrations per second. Another way to look at it is Livermore lab researchers went and exploded some nuclear weapons at the test site and did some experiments to try to figure out what the amount of radiation was that was deposited on Hiroshima. Not the blast and the heat, but the actual sort of radiation dose. And they estimated that it was 1 million curies that was deposited on Hiroshima.
Wow.
And that's what has dribbled out into the community over the years.
Marilia, when you say test sites, talk about those test sites. I think I'm getting at, there's almost a sense in the United States that, oh, we don't really do these tests anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And where do we do these tests?
Well, I need to answer that two ways. Historically, when we had done full-scale above-ground testing and then after the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963, full-scale underground testing, those tests were done at the Nevada test site on western Shoshone land, and earlier tests were done in the Pacific on the people of the Marshall Islands.
Yeah.
And in fact, full-scale nuclear testing by all of the nuclear armed states has been done predominantly on indigenous peoples who were politically less powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, since we have a testing moratorium and we are signatory to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, although the Senate has never ratified it, we do not do full-scale testing. However, the United States has spent about $90 billion since then, establishing an above ground and partly an underground testing base where each part of a nuclear weapon is in essence tested individually, and that information is put together by supercomputers, and that effort has allowed U.S. nuclear weapons development to continue even in the absence of full-scale testing.
Okay.
So at the Nevada test site, there's an underground subcritical nuclear testing facility. At Livermore, there's something called the National Ignition Facility, which is intended to push the envelope on nuclear weapons physics with respect especially to the later stages of a nuclear explosion. There's a new hydro test facility at Los Alamos that's dedicated to the beginning stages of a nuclear weapons explosion, supercomputers at all the facilities to help put it together. And this is the way in which U.S. testing is still going forward. This is often called simulation, and while the computer part of it is a simulation, I want your listeners to understand that plutonium, tritium, which is the radioactive hydrogen of the hydrogen bomb, uranium, and other nuclear materials are being used in various of these testing apparatus.
We're talking with Marilia Kelly, Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares. Marilia, for someone like yourself, who's just a treasure trove of information about nuclear weapons, it must be a little bit alarming to see the lack of information in the mainstream of United States thinking around these weapons?
It is. Tri-Valley Cares maintains a website, and we have a newsletter that's free if people want to sign up to get our newsletter. There are a number of our colleague organizations who also have great newsletters, but nuclear weapons have, by and large, disappeared from, you know, the 6 o'clock news and the mainstream media. Occasionally, there'll be a story about somebody else's nuclear weapon or somebody else's nuclear weapons program or suspect nuclear weapons program, but the massive U.S. arsenal and the massively expensive U.S. enterprise to continue developing nuclear weapons has fallen, I think, dangerously far off of the radar screen of the American people. Mm. And I don't want to digress, you know, too far and too long into it, but that's actually one reason why Tri-Valley Cares agreed to work to build an audience for the new Hollywood movie, Countdown to Zero, which is a documentary history of the nuclear bomb, and makes the point that the only proper number of nuclear weapons in the world is zero. That's why it's called Countdown to Zero. And while the movie is not perfect and, in our view, spends too little time on U.S. nuclear weapons policy, the U.S. nuclear weapons complex, and the arsenal, it is at least a vehicle for putting this issue front and center. And its goal is to reach young people and others in the United States who aren't thinking about this issue and to get them thinking about it.
Mary Leah, depleted uranium.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that, because I believe that that's being used on some of the weapons that are used in the Middle East and Afghanistan these days.
There are various aspects of depleted uranium. It's a radiological hazard, it's also a chemical hazard, and it's a heavy metal hazard. I read about it being used in weapons, and I know that it is used in weapons. It's not my expertise, although I certainly believe that those weapons should be banned. What is more in my expertise is the facts about how it is used in nuclear weapons development. So depleted uranium is not only one of the constituents often used as case material in a nuclear weapon, but in nuclear weapons experiments, because depleted uranium is not fissile, in other words, it will not have a nuclear chain reaction that will then run away into an explosion, but it is a heavy metal similar in many ways to plutonium-239, which is the fissile core of a nuclear bomb. In some of these tests, depleted uranium is used in place of plutonium-239, and then pictures are taken of, like, how a new design will implode. Will it do what the designer thinks it's going to do? And some of these tests are done here at Livermore, at a testing location called Site 300 in the hills between Livermore and Tracy. And depleted uranium is used including on outdoor firing tables where this stuff is just blown up and allowed to go with the wind.
Hmm. I want to talk about definitely about the events coming up. But before we do that, talk more about that particular piece, the waste, the toxic waste mm-hmm. that's floating around, and the health issues that may or may not be seen out in the Tri-Valley area.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a huge amount of toxic and radioactive waste associated with the development of nuclear weapons. A lot of industrial chemicals are used, volatile organics, carbon tetrachloride, I mean, just a whole lot of chemicals, freon, that you would find in any heavy industrial environment, as well as a plethora of radioactive materials. At Livermore, for example, there have been accidents with plutonium, accidents with uranium, both depleted uranium and uranium-235, which is the fissile isotope of uranium. There have been accidents with curium, with strontium, with cesium, just with mixed fission products in general. There's been a criticality accident in an experiment with weapons-grade uranium, the uranium-235 at Livermore Lab, which very few people know about. There's been plutonium accidentally dumped down drains that went to the city sewage treatment plant and was then given away in sludge as a free soil amendment to community members. There's a lot of tritium, the radioactive hydrogen of the hydrogen bomb of which I spoke earlier, that's gone into the air, into the soil, into the groundwater. At Site 300, there's both tritium and uranium in the groundwater, along with all of these toxic contaminants. At the Livermore Lab main site, there's a toxic stew of contaminants that also includes tritium.
And how is it stored?
Obviously, poorly. The waste that are not put into the environment directly by accident, spills, leaks, they're stored a little differently depending on what it is, but most of it's in 55-gallon drums.
Oh, okay. Yikes, say no more. Coincidentally, I've been doing a lot of research myself on the way military bases are turned back into brownfields and then communities put upon them. We've been working a lot with Bayview Hunters Point. I live in Alameda, which, as you know, is a Superfund site.
Yes, I do know.
And actually, it's really, really frightening. And now to hear what's going on out there, too, where it's as if, you know, well, you don't have to worry about this. We're taking care of it all and you'll be safe.
Yeah, what you don't know can hurt you when it comes to the issues of radioactive and toxic waste.
That's right. Well, let's talk now about the events you have coming up for August 6th and August 9th.
Okay. You mentioned, before I talk about the local action at Livermore, you mentioned at the top of the show, Think Outside the Bomb. And so particularly... youth that are listening, I want to encourage them to Google Think Outside the Bomb, read the stuff on the Tri-Valley Cares website, but also Think Outside the Bomb has its own website, and they're planning a whole series of activities in August near the Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico. And it's the largest youth-led anti-nuclear organization in the country.
Okay.
Tri-Valley Cares and a number of Bay Area peace, justice, and environmental organizations are planning a large demonstration at Livermore Lab on August 6th, Friday, August 6th. As you mentioned, that is the 65th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima on the 6th and Nagasaki on the 9th. And so we've titled our demonstration, 65 Years After Hiroshima, It's Time to Retire the Bomb. Mm-hmm. And we have a program planned. Norman Solomon, who's a great speaker, and some of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard or read his some of his media critique and some of his commentary. He'll be our keynote speaker. A wonderfully kind Habaksha, that is a survivor. Mr. Takamori will be speaking. Kayla Marin, who's a young spoken word artist, who's fabulous, will be there. Daniel Zwickel, who's a really great singer-guitarist. Scott Yunt from my organization will be talking a little bit about what goes on right on the other side of the fence, because we'll be gathered right at the fence of Livermore Lab. We're going to have taiko drumming, so it will be a great event. It begins at 8 a.m. At 8:15 a.m., we'll have a moment of silence, which is the local time, 8:15 a.m., August 6th, when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And at 9 a.m., when the program concludes, we'll have a short march, and there'll be an opportunity for nonviolent direct action at the Livermore Lab West Gate. So we're asking people to use the power of their presence on August 6th to come to Livermore Lab and to lift their voices with all of our voices to demand that the U.S. implement its nuclear disarmament obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that all nuclear weapons development work at Livermore Lab cease, that the money that's used in this country to continue nuclear weapons development be shifted to the dismantlement of nuclear weapons and to the cleanup of the toxic and radioactive contamination. And so we're going to be honoring the suffering of those who died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the suffering of the Habaksha who survived, often with visible as well as invisible scars, and to stand with them and say never again to any future use of a nuclear weapon by anyone under any circumstance, and also, you know, call for global nuclear disarmament, the elimination of nuclear weapons worldwide, and call on our government, which was the only government to have used a nuclear weapon in war, and which has done so twice, to really lead toward disarmament.
So that's Friday, August 6th, 65 years after Hiroshima, time to retire the bomb, begins at 8 a.m. And listeners can go to the website trivalleycares.org to get more details on how to get there.
Absolutely. There's a flyer up. People can copy the flyer and circulate it. There's more information and other great resources on the website.
Mary Leah Kelly, Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Mary Leah Kelly, Executive Director of Tri-Valley Cares. Now, here is the trailer clip from the movie that both Dr. Gerson and Mary Leah Kelly have mentioned. It's called Countdown to Zero. It's coming out very soon. I think it's actually may already be out. But here's a clip from that trailer.
We estimate that there are about 23,000 nuclear weapons in the world.
Various groups have been focused on acquiring weapons of mass destruction, in particular nuclear weapons.
All the black market seizures that I'm aware of were caught by luck.
At a Russian naval base in the early 1990s, potatoes were guarded better.
Iran, North Korea, they are prepared to start trading nuclear weapons technology.
The objective of Al-Qaeda is to, quote, kill 4 million Americans. You're not going to get to kill 4 million people by hijacking airplanes and crashing them into buildings.
The United States launched a rocket from Norway to study the Northern Lights. We told the Russians that we were going to launch that rocket, but somebody in Moscow forgot to pass word on it.
The Russians actually opened up the command and control launch codes, the button, put it on the desk, and said, we're under attack. Fortunately, Yeltsin wasn't drunk, and he didn't believe what the military was telling him.
Highly enriched uranium is now within the grasp of any country.
It doesn't take a Manhattan Project to make a bomb.
We've got to ensure that never once do terrorists succeed in detonating a nuclear weapon.
All of the forces on launch ready alert could kill over 100 million Russians and Americans within 30 minutes.
I state with conviction America's commitment to seek a world without nuclear weapons.
Would it not be better to do away with them entirely?
The optimum number is none.
None.
We'd be better off without them.
I say zero.
No nuclear weapons.
Zero.
Zero.
Zero nuclear weapons.
None.
The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us.
And that is our show for today. Again, visit RaisingSandRadio.org, where we archive all our shows for anyone to download. And again, we're a project of Mother Speak, fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. You can make a donation to us via motherspeak.org or raisingsandradio.org, where you can also support us by purchasing any of our shows that are on CD. Just go to the website and you can find out about the shows. Every show has a little blurb that describes what's there. And if you want something on a CD, let me know and I will get it out to you. And there's a very small charge for that. Recently, I've taken to playing Louis Armstrong's piece, What a Wonderful World, because I think it really is a way to remind us what we are doing all of this hard work for, all of this hard work of getting our voices out and trying to have cogent conversations with people around the country so that we are understanding the kind of predicament that we're in these days, and that it's not hopeless, that in fact if we get together and really pool our resources and our thinking and our creativity, we can come up with a much more manageable world, a much more sustainable world. Yes, it will be hard work, but I think we can do it, bringing together all of the different voices that need to be heard in this world. So I'm going to say thank you, Louis Armstrong, for this wonderful piece of music, and let's go out with that.
What a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I never knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.